Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
Right, so Tim, one of the things that I often get asked by family law clients is whether or not a court can make them sell their home. And I don't know about you, but for me the answer is maybe, depending on what people are seeking and what your circumstances are, because Section 79 and Section 90 SM of the Family Law Act basically allow the court to make such order as it considers appropriate in altering property between parties, and that can include the sale of a property, or it also can include the transfer of a property if someone can adjust their interests accordingly. So is that a question you also get asked regularly?
It is, and it's a bit of a vexed issue, because also when that question is asked, it's kind of at what stage of the matter we're in. For instance, if we're negotiating some interim orders or trying to resolve interim issues and one party wants to sell the home but the other party doesn't, that's a really problematic position for the court to be in if we're in proceedings and so on and so forth. But if we're at the finality of the proceedings, the question becomes a lot bigger.
Yeah, and there are some interesting things that fall from people either being able to keep a property and pay out their spouse or having to sell it. One of the really important things to ask a client when they're going through this process and considering it is, can they keep the house? Because if they have an order or a financial agreement, then you get a stamp duty exemption on the transfer of the property. So that can be a really big financial incentive and benefit to the person who is able to retain the home. You know, the other thing is, if parties have to sell a home, obviously there's things like sales costs and the fluidity of the market in terms of what they can expect to achieve from that. So there's a lot of things to consider, in my opinion.
There's a lot of moving parts there as well. You know, I've been in situations where I've asked clients to, you know, speak to their mortgage broker before we go to a conciliation conference or a mediation so that they can confirm their capacity to refinance, because that's what they want to do. And they haven't done that. And we've gotten to the stage of being at the mediation or conciliation conference. And, you know, their desire is to retain the property, but there's, you know, it's unsure as to whether or not that will happen or not. You know, it's about being organised and working out exactly what you want and what's realistic.
Yeah, and I mean, if property is encumbered by a mortgage, you'd probably agree that the bank holds all the cards in terms of this negotiation, because at the end of the day, you know, the bank has to, or, you know, whatever financial institution you use, they have to approve people's borrowing capacity. The other thing that I often get asked about, or that people seem to be under the misapprehension about, is, you know, their responsibilities to discharge a mortgage to enable a transfer to their spouse. So, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, look, I'm just going to take over the mortgage and keep paying it, and that's what our deal is. And two problems flow from that. One is, you know, unless you discharge and refinance the mortgage, the bank's not going to allow the transfer to be affected to the person retaining the home. The second thing is, if you're the other side of that scenario who said, sure, you pay the mortgage, when you go out and then want to, you know, buy something or do something else, the bank's going to go, well, hang on a minute, you're still on this loan over here, why would we give you that money? And so, you know, people need to have some finality to these arrangements and really know that they can borrow an amount that's required to refinance the mortgage and pay out their spouse and have that clean break. And you would be aware, you know, we have the clean break. Yeah, we have the clean break principle, which is that people should have a proper finalization of their financial relationships between one another.
One problem with this is that, and I think that this is perhaps a symptom of COVID, is that, you know, the standard terms or order for the transfer of a property is 60 days. I'm finding, and I think you found this in a couple of your matters too, the bank have slowed right down with their ability to move on these sorts of issues.
Yeah.
So we're finding compliance with orders is becoming difficult just by virtue of the circumstances we're in, where the banks are, you know, moving everyone working from home, the processes and internal processes are slower for people to be able to arrange a refinance and transfer and do all the things that they need to do, and that's complex.
Yeah, I certainly think there's been feedback from mortgage brokers as well that, you know, lending institutions are taking a lot, like, even though interest rates are down, and who knows when this podcast will be listened to, so this may be completely redundant by then, but, you know, interest rates are down, but, you know, getting approval for things is taking longer. But, you know, in terms of the timing of a refinance arrangement, I think that's a really interesting concept, because there is no fixed rule about what needs to be in an order or an agreement in terms of someone being able to refinance. So, I mean, sometimes you see orders and they're like, you've got 28 days, which you think is super ambitious, in my view, to put in an order. Sometimes people put 60 days. Sometimes it's 90. Sometimes it's a matter of months. Obviously, people can also agree to things like, you know, you have X amount of years to refinance to enable someone to stay in the home, maybe until their kids finish high school or get to a certain age before that requirement's required. I mean, that's more unusual.
I've seen that happen too when a market's particularly down. I've had that happen with rural properties, farms and so on, where the parties, it's in their both of their financial interest to wait until there's some sort of recovery there that is foreseeable.
Yeah.
Like, that is common practice.
Yeah, and I mean, that might be, you know, in pretty dire circumstances really important as well, if there's been some lull in the market and, you know, parties might be left with a debt if they sell the property. To give one side the ability to refinance out of it might actually suit both parties. But, you know, there's
a bit of a vexed issue though. I've had that happen before where, you know, there's a position that, oh, you know, they're in the property, they should take the debt. And my view is, well, but you want some of the proceeds of sale too. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a negotiation, isn't it? And that's part of this process of, you know, if you look at the Act and what it says quite explicitly, you know, it's about making orders that that are appropriate and orders that are just and equitable. And they're, you know, some pretty big concepts to navigate in terms of stuff. I think we probably don't get so theoretical when we're negotiating outside of a court and, you know, in a mediation or just talking about the practicalities of stuff, but they're the big concepts that we're actually going through. But I guess the other issue is that's more around someone keeping the property and transferring it for the benefit that we've identified before. But if people can't keep a property, or, you know, one of the other things that's really important that I'll just touch on now is, even if you have orders or an agreement that provide for one party to retain the property, you know, as part of a transfer and a refinance, it's really important to have that order that in the event that they don't do it within that time frame, you know, there's a sale, because you don't want to have to go back to court for enforcement proceedings when you can have self-executing orders or an agreement that already provide for that mechanism to occur.
That's our job, I think, is to think about solutions to problems that exist now and that could potentially exist in the future. And I think that even if there is that security that, you know, somebody has the financial capacity, they may have cash in an account to pay someone out or do whatever the case may be, to have those default sale provisions and so on and so forth. And things like, you know, it's usually the case that when you're negotiating orders, one party or one spouse lives in the house while the other party's out. You know, there would normally be provision for who's going to pay the mortgage until a transfer happens or a sale happens, or, you know, utilities, rates, you know, if it's an investment property, land tax, you know, all of those sorts of things, you know, need to be thought about in the process.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking about problem solving for future possible problems, you know, in your orders, whether it be that you're just having orders to sell a property or you're having orders that are meant to be self-executing in the event that there's non-compliance, you know, it's really important to have some of those things explicitly in the orders. And it can also be things like who's going to do the conveyance on your property, who's going to be the agent, what's the mechanism for determining a listing price, who pays outgoings, things like who pays for any upfront advertising costs, Can you think of any other things? Like, well, I mean, you
that
know,
really ties into another issue, which is a little bit broader but useful for this context, is that it's really quite in vogue now for simple, plain drafting in family law.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when we're dealing with self-represented litigants, or, you know, they sign on the dotted line and they move on, they've got lawyers, particularly with parenting orders, which is a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really important that people can read those documents and understand exactly what their obligations are.
Yeah.
And good drafting in orders, in my view, is simple but also concise. So, like what you said about nominating who the conveyancer is, if that can be agreed and put into the orders, that removes a further potential dispute that could happen between the parties once the lawyers are out of it and they're trying to, you know, move forward or do what they need to do. I mean, we usually, you know, with compliance and so on, we'll stay around just so that we can make sure things happen and compliance is met. But, you know, thinking about removing obstacles to the finalisation of a settlement, I think is a really positive thing and should be thought about when the orders are being drafted in the first place.
Yeah, and look, people can be really negative about lawyers and say, oh, look, you know, they just want to litigate stuff for the monetary gain that might happen. But I can tell you now, I don't want to be, you know, having to get back into a matter to help clients navigate who the conveyancing solicitor is going to be, or how you get access to a property, or who does, you know, the required works before it sells. You just think that kind of work, it's just painful for everyone. And lawyers are like, oh my God, you know, this is such a drama. But I mean, we'll do it, but it's obviously best practice that that's already addressed in any orders or agreement you have, so that there's no question about what everyone's going to be doing.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, something to think about with that, people do think that lawyers are, you know, adversarial and we want to go to court, we want to do all these things. There are some matters that are absolutely necessary that I think, you know, require the intervention of the court.
Yeah.
But there are some matters which you just sit back and laugh and you just think this is a simple problem for which there is a simple answer. And I think avoiding litigation in those sorts of circumstances assists everybody. I mean, you know, people talk about the monetary impost of litigation, the mental health that, you know, will suffer as a result of that as well. There are so many consequences to litigation. And I think that limiting the scope for dispute, especially once you've gone through the rigmarole of achieving an outcome for your property settlement, just seems like a good idea to me.
Yeah. And I mean, if we look at it even more holistically, you know, and putting on our kind of caring hats, because we are family lawyers and we care, you know, what you don't want is for litigants who might, or, you know, just clients who might have sorted out all this stuff, to have these really small issues that then might impact on, you know, how well they communicate, that then impacts, you know, their parenting matter and how well they're dealing with the other aspects of their life and living in this post-separation environment. Like, I think, you know, we've got to be really careful to make sure that we're helping clients in this process to get to a point where the issues that can be sorted out and should be sorted out while they've got legal assistance are dealt with. And then, look, you know, all that other stuff about, you know, you're feeding Johnny carrots in the lunchbox and I want to feed him apples. I mean, that's their future problem. We don't have to deal
that's
with that.
Right.
Like,
that's
you
exactly
know.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And I think that's, you know, it goes to the heart of it, is to minimise conflict. And I think that, you know, we are in an emotionally charged jurisdiction, you know, the breakdown of a relationship and everything that goes with that. You know, it's when you're dealing with people's finances and with their children, you know, these are issues that cut incredibly close to home.
Yeah.
And, you know, our job as lawyers, as I said before, is to look for solutions to problem. We need to minimise conflict and the opportunity for conflict in these sorts of issues, because you're right, it has consequences beyond choosing the real estate agent or who's going to be the auctioneer, you know, when there's other decisions about drop-offs at school and pickups and, you know, who's going to go to this assembly and all of that sort of stuff. Like, you know, negotiating all of that, it's a neat little package that needs to be managed.
Yeah, and, you know, there's some interesting things that, you know, we, as a matter of course, put in orders. Like, for example, if you go back to things like picking a real estate agent, you know, it's pretty common that you'd have orders that, you know, parties have a time to agree on which agent they will use, And if they can't agree, you can approach the president of the Real Estate Institute of your state and territory to make that decision for you. Obviously, if you go down that path, and I think it's really important to talk to clients about this, you know, there's costs involved in that process, but, you know, you've got to kind of have this chain of decision-making in your orders so that, you know, your orders have the effect that you intended them to have.
And I think that that comes back to our skill as lawyers. It's our job to think about these things and make sure that any potential kind of fallout on these issues is minimised. I mean, you know, it's quite common that we would have clients come to us where they've tried to achieve a property settlement by themselves. They've tried to draft orders and do their application and so on. With respect to those people, they've butchered it, not because of their any other deficiency other than they're not a family lawyer and they're not trained and they don't know how to do these documents. And I think that there's a skill involved in this for which, you know, a specialist family lawyer can assist to minimise that. And I think it's money well spent.
Yeah, and can I say, I think you're really clever and you draft really good orders. So,
thank you. So do you.
Yeah, thanks, thanks. And I'm not saying that just because we work together, or I might be. But, you know, it is a really important thing. In terms of, you know, selling a home or not selling a home, is there anything else that you think we need to talk about, or are you happy for us to have a chat to, you know, what it's like from an agent's perspective and what kind of things they find might need to be, you know, explicit or addressed in that process from their end of the coin?
I think as well, just one other thing to touch on, there are many reasons to why someone would sell a home during the course of family law proceedings. For instance, you know, there may be an interim agreement to do it. The market may be heightened and they think if we do this now, and then the money will sit in a controlled monies account accruing interest until they can finalise their dispute.
Yeah.
You know, it's common practice that would happen, and, you know, if they need to rehouse or do whatever they need to do, they may agree to have an interim property settlement, which means, you know, they may each take $50,000 each from the $300,000 sitting in that controlled monies account to set up a new home, or, you know, more money for a deposit on a new property. Like, people do things in all sorts of different ways. I think it's just a case of, you know, talking about your lawyer what your current goals are for the next 6 to 12 months and talk about what your long-term goals are, because that directly impacts any potential property settlement. And, you know, things to think about as well, if it's an investment property, there are capital gains tax consequences as well. You know, the full court case of Rosati and how to deal with all of those sorts of things as well are complications that we need to look at as well. And it's a thing to think about as well for a client's perspective, is when we're looking at options for a property settlement, it may be useful to pull in their accountant or their financial advisor, because, you know, people are becoming more and more complex in the way that they arrange their finances, and having advice as to the most economical and practical way to divide assets is also really useful when we're talking about the bigger picture.
And I think that's a really important point as well, because, you know, lots of people do have investment properties, and, you know, the taxation consequences through capital gains tax is an important thing to factor in if it can be factored in. And obviously, if people are, you know, proposing to sell a property as part of their deal, then it can be, you know, taken into account. But sometimes people say, oh, well, I'm going to keep that property and, you know, but, you know, if I sell it in X period of time, I'm going to have this capital gains consequence. And you think, well, you know, you're taking on the property. It's not necessarily factored in as a joint liability in the asset pool. So people, in terms of the negotiations, need to have a think about what they want to achieve and really what their longer term plans are with respect to property, so that, you know, their lawyers can go, okay, we can factor that in, or we can't factor it in, or this is what it's going to look like for you.
That's really important, because, you know, we are lawyers, we're not accountants, we're not qualified to give that advice. I mean, you know, by virtue of our experience and the things that we do, we have a pretty good idea of where things are going to go and being able to identify those issues. But having that expert advice is absolutely essential to know what the lay of the land is. I mean, I think the rule of thumb is, if the CGT event is in the foreseeable future, we put it on the balance sheet, you know, and there are consequences to that as well as to where that goes and who it sits with and all of that sort of stuff. These are things that we need to think about to achieve a property settlement that is just and equitable in all of the circumstances.
Yeah, and look, the other thing is, It's really fun to work with accountants and other, you know, experts and advisors in terms of sorting out your family law matter, because, you know, especially things like financial planners, and if you're looking at couples who are getting closer to retirement age and whether or not, you know, how they should, you know, either keep more super or property or whatever, like, you know, it can be really enlightening for your client and also for us as the family lawyers to have feedback from people who can give that advice so that we can assist clients in structuring the best outcome. And certainly I know I really value engagement with other professionals in that context. I mean, how do you feel about it?
I think it's absolutely essential. I mean, something that I'm finding more and more is that the way in which people construct their property settlements or their wish list of outcomes is becoming more complex. Mm. For instance, you know, it may be more attractive for somebody to have more cash out of their sale or transfer of a house as opposed to a super split. And that proposal may be more advantageous to the other party who has more super, but it may be, you know, a younger party who, if they've got that extra cash, will reduce the mortgage they've got to pay and they can actually live a better life in the foreseeable future, then focus on rebuilding their super. You know, there are so many different ways to do this, and I think that having that advice is essential.
Yeah, and I mean, look, the wish list is generally, I just want everything, how can you make that happen? Well, like, you know, I don't have a magic wand, but we can, you know, workshop what might be realistic. But coming back to, I guess, our discussion today, that also leads us to, you know, the process of, if you're looking at selling your home, one of the really, you know, important other people you can engage with are people who sell homes, i.e. real estate agents, to be able to talk to them about what they might need, what it's going to look like in terms of possible sale outcomes or timeframes and things. And sometimes it's good for clients to go and have those conversations before we have to start structuring their deal as well, because they might say, look, this is a really bad time, or, oh my goodness, get your property on the market now, or you need to do these things and it's going to cost you $40,000 to get your house up to scratch, but you'll make X. And those are the kinds of things that we might need to factor into our negotiations, you know, in
terms
drafting.
Of... drafting, like, if, exactly. If it is the case, like you said, you know, it's really, instead of doing like a blanket provision saying, you know, reimbursement for somebody for X,
yeah,
to say, you know, $40,000 extra in the progression of those orders makes it really clear and makes it, removes again the possibility of a dispute on that issue.
Yeah, I mean, clarity is key, and you know, it's really important. But this is exciting now, and I'm excited that we're going to have a chat to someone about the sale process. But it's been nice chatting to you as well, Tim.
I'm enjoying our podcast journey. This is fantastic.
I know. The journey is good.
The journey is good.
Perfect. All right, let's go to our next little stage.
Let's do it.
In the next episode, we'll be talking to Luke Wilson, our real estate guru. Stay tuned.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.